Okay, starting the device at this moment. The device has begun.
All right, good. Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. From Portland, Oregon, you are my co-host, Richard Wally.
You are my host of co-ing, that is Cassidy Robinson from Garden Grove, California.
Yes, Garden Grove, I like that.
Groove.
Garden Grove, it's kind of a different thing. Maybe I'll like have that like decaled on the side of my Chevy Cavalier
in some old English writing.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe some maybe lower your car by like 4 inches.
Yeah, no.
And some spinning rims. No, no lights, nothing.
No. Okay. So my big drama since the last time we did one of these.
Oh, exciting!
My car's low enough as it is. Because
oh, this was going somewhere. I thought this was just like I'm done talking about that, Richard.
Enough with your silly gag. No, I pulled out of my parking lot to go gas station or something, whatever, and decided I don't want to be going this direction. I want to be going the other direction. So, I just pulled into my neighbor's parking lot, to turn around. And they had like some sort of median that like for some reason splits their entry point of their parking lot just at the beginning. It doesn't go all the way through, it's just at the beginning. And I didn't see it or something, and I just like drove in like there was nothing there, and it put a giant crack in my oil pan. And I went and did whatever, came back, and then like 2 hours later my landlady knocked on my door and said, "You have a giant puddle of oil under your car." And I opened the door, and sure enough, yes, I did. A sizable puddle.
Well, that's fun.
So $500 later, I have my car fixed. It was very upsetting. But on the same day, on the very same day that I went to have my car fixed, I had to like hang out in a Starbucks for a few hours. And I had nothing but my new phone, so I decided I'll do what the kids are doing these days, and I'll Twitter or something. Even though I was running out of battery power in my phone as well. And I scroll down and I see that Spawn's Michael Jai White has been following me.
Well, why Spawn specifically? He's been in like movies and stuff since then, probably.
I feel as though that's probably what most people know him from. He is the lead actor who played Spawn. Yeah, he was in Black Dynamite. He had a bit part in The Dark Knight. Yeah. He's in stuff.
He's in stuff. No, I'm just saying. He's also in the new show Arrow.
WB. I don't watch that, but yes, apparently he's in that.
No, Black Dynamite. That's a good one.
Black Dynamite, I enjoy a lot. I have no idea why he's following me. I looked at like the last like 10 or so tweets that I did before that to see if somebody retweeted me that might somehow get back to Michael Jai White.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't see anything. I know that back in the day when I did Video Clerks on YouTube, me and Christopher gave a really positive review to Black Dynamite. Maybe he somehow floated across that?
Who knows?
I don't know.
I hope he listens. It is. That would be great.
You what?
I hope he listens. I want to
so
have
too.
A dialogue with him.
Michael Jai White, if you're listening to this episode right now, shoot us an email. jabberonthedrone@gmail.com.
I personally would like to talk
to you. Or just
to
tweet me.
We'll have a Black Dynamite episode.
All right. What have you been up to? I saw that the other day you went to a screening of Carrie.
I did go to a screening.
The original Brian De Palma Carrie, the good Carrie.
Yes, the one that you don't rant on every few hours or so. I swear, like every like week or so, I see you posting something horrible about the remake.
Not that often.
Close.
I mean, once in a while in the middle of the night, I'll wake up in a cold sweat, and then I just have to bury my face in a pillow and scream. But that's really the worst it ever got.
Wow, that really affected you. I just forgot about it. I thought it was a pretty easy procedure. But we watched a screening. It's for I believe it's the 38th year of the movie. It wasn't the exact date, but that's why they were watching it. But we did a screening with Piper Laurie. Who played the mother in that movie.
Yes.
It's kind of a big thing, so people probably know of her.
There were a few other actors there, too, wasn't there?
PJ Souls. She is the one that wore the red hat. She was one of the bullies.
She was also in Halloween.
Yeah. And the other one is the girl from RoboCop, Nancy Allen.
Yeah. She was a big De Palma lady. She was in like a lot of his movies at the time. She was in Blowout, and she was also in
Dress to Kill.
Yeah.
So yeah, they were all there. They did a Q&A afterwards, and they were pretty adorable. PJ Souls was also in Rock and Roll High School. So
awesome.
The only interesting thing that came up that I remember specifically from it was that Piper Lawyer Laurie.
Piper Laurie.
Piper Laurie, actually, she didn't... that was her, like, first movie in a long time, actually. And she didn't really understand Brian De Palma's kind of, like, style.
Mm-hmm.
And she thought that the movie was supposed to be, like, a, like, comedy.
Yeah.
And so she prepared her character as, like, a satire.
Yeah, And then
when she was there practicing... Brian De Palma was like, what are you doing? And she's like, oh, and she kind of caught on that it wasn't supposed to be. And she actually, she said that she actually just tweaked it just enough to make it, to make it a horrifying versus a comedic. So that's actually kind of interesting.
That is interesting, especially if you watch that performance, because, it is a very big performance and pretty broad, and it could be seen as kind of mawkish.
Mm.
But because of De Palma's style, of the overall movie, which is really quite aggressive, and because of, you know, the interplay between her and why am I forgetting her name?
I don't know. Sissy Spacek?
Sissy Spacek, thank you.
Okay.
Because of the interplay between those two, and Sissy's playing it so differently and playing it so straight, that it really just makes her terrifying.
That's fair.
It's one of my favorite performances ever, really.
It's a good one. Well, talking about quotable, my mom always quoted, "They're all going to laugh at you," until I was like, a teenager and I didn't even know it. I didn't see that movie until I was like in like my preteen, so like 12, 13 year old range. My mom would say that randomly, and I'd be like, "Okay, weirdo." And then I finally got it when I was an adult. I was like, "Oh yeah, she used to say that to me."
They're all going to laugh at you.
Yeah, I don't blame people at these things for asking dumb questions.
Yeah, I'm sure they're used to it. Like. That's the type of movie that has that kind of fandom. Like, it's not like you went to the Big Chill 35-year reunion. You know, like...
Well, it's also hard for me with actors and actresses, because you can only kind of ask them about specific things to do with their characters or who they know. And some of those questions really aren't that interesting to me. The only thing that I could think of while I was sitting there, and I didn't ask it just because I would feel like an asshole, would be like, so... Was Tommy Ross's hair, was that real? Was his hair really that golden lush? That was my one question that was in my head.
I have a feeling like that question would have went really well over on that crowd.
You're probably right.
I think that would have been pretty appropriate.
No, I after it was almost done, I felt like it would have been very appropriate. But that was
how disappointing would that have been to find out that was a wig the whole time, though? That would crush.
I know exactly. That's why I wanted to know.
You didn't want to know.
Yeah, I did know. Yeah, that's where it went to.
That'd be like finding out that Mark Hamill was actually had a buzz cut underneath the wig with all three Star Wars movies.
Yeah, disappointing truth about people's hair.
Well, let's go ahead and get on to our movie news. And we have some interesting stuff here. We are going to talk about the Oscars, which just happened last night for us. This will be posting Tuesday, but we watched it on Sunday. So we'll be discussing that in our pet topic. But before we get into any of that, what do you have for us?
First I'll go with this one. So David Fincher is in early talks to do a Steve Jobs film for Sony. I believe it's from the same writer as The Social Network.
That would be Aaron Sorkin?
Maybe that's a lie then. I thought it said something about that, but I might be remembering. No, it does say.
Does it not say on your article?
Sources tell that in early talks to do the untitled drama written by Oscar-winning screenwriter Aaron Sorkin. So it would be another Aaron Sorkin thing. So I think it would be actually really in line with Social Network. It sounds like kind of a really interesting project from him. Mm-hmm. And he could do some kind of weird in the cyber age kind of trilogy thing. Maybe. No, I'm kind of serious, actually. I think that these types of, you know, this is some of his, it's not some of the stuff that people automatically go, oh, David Fincher kind of film. But yeah. For me, it's some of his best work as well, though. So I don't know. I'm actually kind of into this. What do you think?
I think he should tread carefully. Because
he was going to cast Ashton Kutcher, but that, you
know. Well, that's the thing. First of all, we have a recent Steve Jobs biopic failure, still in our rear view. Mm-hmm. And I feel like whatever ill will has been placed on that could bleed over into whatever next project gets started. If they don't let let the public consciousness kind of forget. Sure. And that's just, you know, I'm not saying anything about the quality of whatever they're going to do or the idea of doing this project. I just mean, you know, on a financial ground, I don't think it's very safe. And then on top of it, I love Social Network. It's one of my favorite movies of the last decade or so, but it's also kind of a lightning in a bottle movie. Mm-hmm. Like, I think, you know, the comments that it's making about society, the, you know, the actors they got to play those parts, Aaron Sorkin's screenplay mixing with David Fincher's visual style, a combination nobody would have ever thought about putting together, but happened to work really well. All of those things, I feel like that movie can only happen once, or at least happen like that once.
Sure.
And I kind of feel like, you know, funnily enough, there was a movie a long time ago, an old TV movie starring Noah Wiley from ER. Called The Pirates of Silicon Valley, about the early days of Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and their friendly competition.
Yeah, I remember it.
Yeah, it was kind of a big deal at the time, like in the late 90s.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I don't remember much about it. I just remember one scene where they're like in a garage and
yeah,
who cares? But
I remember when Social Network first got announced and when they kind of showed what was some of the early trailers, I was like, oh, so this is like the modern day The Pirates of Silicon Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And now, I don't know, now it's like the snake is eating its own tail. It's all coming back into full circle. It's a very strong creative team. I kind of believe that David Fincher's incapable of making a bad movie. There are some of his that I don't like as much as others. And Aaron Sorkin's a terrific writer. I don't know. I'm kind of mixed on it. I almost feel like, you know, I'm very excited to see what Gone Girl's going to be.
Sure, agreed.
And I like that he's, you know, not just like jump. I don't know. Like, it's hard to tell which one's for him and which one isn't anymore.
I think that this, you know. Even if it gets some of the lightning and not all of it, Mm-hmm. Even if it's just a positively charged movie, it'll still be good. So
I just don't want it to be his to the wonder. You know what I mean? It's like he made, you know, Terrence Malick released Tree of Life, and everyone's like, "Oh my god, you know, this is revolutionary." And then he released To the Wonder, and everyone's like, "You just did that."
Well, yeah, but there's been, I think To the Wonder wasn't that his next movie, as opposed to, I mean, David Fincher's had some time in between these.
A little
two.
Bit. Yeah.
And just because it's in development right now doesn't mean how long it's going to take to get it off the road and what they're going to do to kind of get it going. So I think that it's an early positive sign.
Yeah.
So.
I mean, I'm much more excited about this news, even if it's not the most exciting thing all those people could be doing. I'm much more excited about this news than, you know,
7-2.
Well,
7.02 or something like that. I don't know how you'd have to do that one, but
I was gonna say like a World of Warcraft movie, but yeah,
I think that would be cool from David Fincher.
I'm just not so sure.
It's I think gonna you're be wrong.
Cool from anybody.
You're so wrong. We'll see. We'll see. I think if you're gonna bring that up, Duncan Jones, I think is a very capable director, and I like his attitude and everything going into it. So we will see, my friend.
All right.
Well, actually, I'm very hesitant when I say that. But yeah, I'm going to be on the positive side for that one.
My first news item, another kind of, I don't know, maybe this is a match made in hell. Bret Easton Ellis, the writer of American Hustle, not American Hustle, American Psycho, and Lesson Zero, is teaming up with Rob Zombie, you know, that Rob Zombie to...
I believe Manson is part of that project as well.
To team up for a Charles Manson movie.
Yeah, that's what it was.
Yeah, the other the Manson. The one who's really a psycho, not just one for Halloween. What do you think about this?
I think it could be really good for both of them, because you don't let... Okay, so Bret Easton Ellison's kind of style, I think, would work well with that cold detachedness with Rob Zombie's kind of, like, kitschy craziness.
Yeah, like everything at the kitchen sink kind of approach.
Yeah. Well, also just kind of, like, I think that Bret Easton Ellis has more of a handle on language and stuff. Like, something that, I mean, you always notice Rob Zombie's language in his films, for me.
Yeah, his dialogue's kind of bad. And a lot of times
it's not... It's not good.
Yeah.
So I think that they could balance each other out. I think it's an interesting take. And I also think it would be really interesting to have them work within parameters, that human parameters. Mm-hmm. And so they kind of have to... I mean, they can still play in that weird 60s psychedelic kind of whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. To me, this sounds kind of cool, and I'm more excited about it than less. I've always thought Rob Zombie needed somebody there to kind of help prop up some of his strange Mad Hatter kind of ways.
Yeah. He kind of needs an editor.
Yeah, well, he needs an editor kind of. Yeah, exactly. He needs not just an editor, but somebody to kind of balance him out and bounce things off of.
But do you really think that Bret Easton Ellis is that guy? Because, I mean, I like Bret Easton Ellis as a writer, and he's an interesting cult of personality as well. And he's very interesting ideas about film and books and literature and pop culture. But I think both of these guys are kind of people who need people to tell them no sometimes. And I don't know. I'm a little worried about them taking on specifically, I mean, it would be one thing if they were just writing a horror movie together. But the fact that they're taking on something that's based on truth that actually happened, and they both have sort of a nihilistic output, although I think Ellis actually has Rob Zombie beat on that front.
Oh yeah, easy peasy.
So yeah, Ellis can be a very cerebral writer, as well as nihilistic, and that could be interesting to bring into Rob Zombie's more visceral cinema fanboyish kind of qualities. I'm worried that it's going to get out of hand.
I'm kind of halfway hoping it will.
I
don't know. See, to me,
but this is two, this is what I was styles.
They have very similar. They don't have very similar styles. And the things that you're saying is the nose. The things that they both need, they both get out of hand.
Yeah.
They both have like opposite things they get out of hand with. So maybe, see, I think it's more, it'll be a good balance.
Okay.
And I want their kind of madball craziness to bleed through still.
Yeah.
Cause you don't want to have a project from either of them and not have that.
Yeah.
Why would you want anything from them that isn't, I don't want something
a little kind of unpredictable.
Yeah, well, just unpredictable and just nihilistic and probably dark and kind of mean. That's what I would expect from them. So why wouldn't I want that?
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, the worst thing that could happen is if they ended up being boring.
Yeah.
And I was telling a friend who just noticed this on his iPhone when we were out eating, and he was kind of upset about it. And I was like, well, think of it this way: if they fail, they're gonna fail big.
Mm-hmm.
It's not gonna be pretty, like, or easy to forget. So, yeah, I mean, I give them the green light. I'm excited to see what comes out of it. I'm just glad I'm not their producer. Let's just say that.
No, I'm genuinely kind of interested in it. Like, to me, that seems like a good pairing.
Yeah.
We'll see what it is. I didn't see anything about where they're looking to do this.
You mean
mini movie project?
You mean like what? Like where it's going to premiere? Or what do you mean? I don't. It doesn't say that much about it.
Yeah.
Other than they just kind of started talking. The pair envision a project as sorts of sprawling. It's a mini series. Multi-perspective mini series. Yeah, exploring the events before, during, and after the infamous murder spree.
Well, yeah, that's what I was talking about. Like, where is this going to be on? Is it going to be on Fox proper? Is it going to be on FX? Who is it going through? Or is it on another station and it's just being...
They might be shopping it at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, what else do you have?
The other thing that I have is Mr. Vincent D'Onofrio has come up to play the villain, apparently, in the new Jurassic World.
I thought they already started filming this.
I have no idea. This is one of those films that every time I hear something, like, I get excited because of the person that's involved.
Yeah.
But then I remember it's Jurassic World, and I go, what? What's going on here? Like, it just seems like, okay. So this is to add to, you know, Chris Pratt being one of the lead persons, apparently. Bryce Dallas Howard's in there, Ty Simpkins and Nick Robinson.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got Colin, I can't pronounce his last name, Trevorrow from Safety Not Guaranteed.
Yeah.
He's going to be the directing on it.
And
then
weird.
You go,
yeah.
Oh, by the way, Vincent D'Onofrio is going to be playing the villain, which he's always been, I always thought he's made really great villains in films. I don't know. This is just another one where I'm like, oh, that's exciting, but it's Jurassic World.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have an opinion on this?
Yeah, I don't know. I think ultimately this whole Jurassic World stuff, I'm kind of like, I just can't get that invested at this point. Like, if it's great, it's kind of like when The Last Planet of the Apes came out. I was just kind of up to the point I saw it. I was like, if it's awful, I'm not going to be heartbroken.
Yeah.
Because I kind of expect it. But if it's great, cool. And it ended up being good. And I was like, oh, good deal. Thank you for living up to your franchise for once. So if that's what happens here and it ends up being a big comeback for the series and it, you know, sparks new life into it, great, awesome. I do not expect that. And Vincent D'Onofrio, he's an okay actor. I've liked him in certain things. I liked him in Men in Black. I liked his like little bit part playing Orson Welles in Ed Wood.
Sure.
In general, I don't know. Like, I have a hard time kind of forgiving him for his extremely over the top performance in Law and Order CI. I remember when that show was really popular and everyone was watching it and they're like, oh, he's so good. I just love how he's so, like, whatever. And I remember watching it and just being like, no cop acts like that. No cop could legally act like that. And it just really bugged me. And I thought he was like, he was just an actor off his leash and nobody was telling him no. And I had, it was just, he was full of like annoying actor tics in that show specifically. I haven't seen him ever be that bad, but in that show, which he was on for a long time, I never could get into his character.
I don't remember. Last time I watched Law and Order was the one with Chris Milanoni or whatever.
Chris Maloney, yeah.
Yeah.
That was Law and Order, or that was SVU, I think. I don't remember. Yeah. Who knows? There's like 17 of those shows.
Yeah, I never ever got into those. So when anybody told me, oh, this guy's really great, and I was like, yeah, I bet he is, and I never watched it. So that's my opinion on that. No, I think he could be an interesting villain, though, specifically.
Yeah.
So, I mean, but at this point, it's just, it is kind of a mixed bag kind of, okay, Jurassic World's coming up, I guess.
Let's, yeah. It's happening, so there it is.
Yeah.
All right, well, that wraps us up on our movie news, and we can get into our pet topic now, which is just gonna go over last night's Academy Awards, the 86th Academy Awards. And I'll just start off the show. Or start off the discussion with, was there any big surprises? Was there any big losses? Anything that really got
it
you?
It was really funny when Bill Murray came on as Bad Grandpa for for the show.
Yeah, that hair, right?
Well, the hair, and he's looking old.
Looked a little haggard.
He's looking, yeah. Well, it was also beautiful when he gave his impromptu RIP to Harold Ramis.
Yeah, that was cool. That was cool.
No, there were a lot of kind of, I don't know, I guess, good moments, and I don't know, it was kind of a mixed bag.
Yeah.
I thought Ellen was funny, mm-hmm. and as good as, you know, definitely better than Franco and
Anne Hathaway.
Anne Hathaway, but I still like the Family Guy, Seth MacFarlane, better.
I did too, and everyone, it's funny, reading like all the stuff today, everyone's all like, finally, return to form after that horrible thing last year, and I just don't understand it.
Like, no, I thought last year was really good.
I thought it was funny, I thought it was tight, it was on point. Yeah, his stuff wasn't like totally 100% safe for work, I guess. I mean, it's not. I mean, even for Seth MacFarlane, that was pretty watered down. But yeah. It was, you know, it was funny and it was relevant. Whereas I thought Ellen was funny. She brought what Ellen does. It was a very similar to her cadence on her talk show.
Agreed.
But I thought her opening monologue was really funny. And then I felt like she, and this is sort of an Oscar thing in general, it's kind of a hard gig because you're working with a 3-hour time span. So it's hard to keep the audience on your side. But once you get past the 90-minute mark. But I felt like the second half of the show, she was really running out of energy, and a lot of the gags were weird. Like, they were barely gags, like her doing a big selfie with a bunch of celebrities. I didn't understand why that was supposed to be funny. And then her,
see, it
kind of like,
seemed off
pizza.
The cuff. I liked those ones.
You liked
they the- were kind of oddball. I liked those. Mine was just the energy in general. Just like, I kind of felt like the performances were kind of deadpan. Like last year, I thought like the like dance numbers and stuff, and this isn't even ever like my thing.
Yeah,
apparently, except for the Oscars. But last year, I thought the dance numbers were really like tight and really like they blended into the show really well.
There was a lot more pageantry last year, whereas this year really felt kind of stripped to the bone.
Exactly, and I didn't really like how it looked. I don't know if that makes sense, but the overall style and stuff of it.
Oh yeah, when they talked about the writers and they had like a big wall of typewriters behind them, it's really who got paid for that one?
Right.
That was a ridiculous idea.
But no, I did like some of it. Like I liked when she snuck up on Leonardo DiCaprio and Sandra Bullock. Sandra Bullock. That was a good one. I like some of the off-the-cuff moments and some of the strangeness of it, because it did seem kind of informal, which is nice for the Oscars, but yeah. In general, the general, like, just pacing and...
To me, it just felt lazy. Like, okay, the joke is we're eating pizza at a place where you shouldn't eat pizza, or the joke is I'm randomly talking to celebrities like I'm not hosting the Oscars. And I felt like those as jokes would have been fine, maybe in context to a punchline somewhere, mm-hmm. but they never really came. It was just sort of these weird, awkward transitions to the next thing. I mean, as far as Oscar telecasts go, it's pretty average. I would say it was like, it'd be like a, you know, from 1 to 10, it'd be like a 6. It was like watchable. It wasn't bad. But it's not particularly memorable either.
Agreed. The selfie was, I thought, was kind of fun and kind of different, but...
Yeah, apparently they broke Twitter, so...
They did. That's pretty exciting, yeah. Though, right? So... I think somebody at the party that I was at said, like, well, you can see the overlap of people who watch the Oscars and Twitter users.
Yeah.
In general, it was okay. I guess I'd give it a little higher than you, like a 7 maybe. But there was something very lackluster about it to me.
Uh-huh.
I thought, I don't know, there was kind of something missing. There was an energy. There was just nothing there, really. It just kind of seemed like watered down.
It just kind of floated along, yeah. If it seemed underproduced, too, like the budget was smaller or something. Like, yeah. And maybe it was. I mean, you know, economy and all that. What about the actual awards themselves? You said when you texted me on the night of after 12 Years a Slave won Best Picture, you asked me what my overall total was. I got 14 out of 24, which is, I don't know, probably about what I do every year. And what about you?
I got 12, which is probably about right, because I usually get the big awards pretty good. But then...
What were your big losers? What were the ones where you're like, ah! Like, you really thought you'd voted right? Or
here, just a second. I can't remember exactly. I know I got... I think I got both actor and supporting actor wrong.
Really?
Yeah, I actually think... I thought that they would do the pity. The okay, we finally need to give one to Leonardo DiCaprio award. I really didn't think that they were going to do that. And then, I don't know, I think I was mostly got tired, because sometimes when I'm looking down at the ballot, I get bored, because there's so much stuff, and there's so many, like, ones that I'm guessing on,
yeah.
That I'm trying to put, like, an educated guess into, and it's just like, I put Jonah Hill, and I as soon as I turned in my ballot, I was like, I did the wrong thing there, I should have, the other thing is, I did not see Dallas, that's the only one I didn't see was Dallas Buyers Club,
yeah.
In theaters, and so it kind of just was out of my mind, though it should have been on top of my mind for doing this.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're just going on what you think will win, not, I mean, if it was what you want to win, it probably would have been Jonah Hill and Leonardo, right?
Yeah, definitely. I thought Jonah Hill actually did deserve it a lot, and I thought that Leonardo DiCaprio does. I had a lot... I didn't see the controversy. I didn't see all the big hubbub. I still think that Wolf of Wall Street is one of the strongest movies on there.
You know, it's funny, as I was thinking about that, because, you know, I had a bunch of my film school friends here, and so there's a lot of opinions flying around.
Sure.
And, you know, almost this universal hatred for Gravity, except for me. Mm-hmm. When I was looking down at the thing, and I'm looking, it's like, okay, as far as films that really kind of push it, and it's really, you know, really the only movie that is pretty ballsy and just doesn't give a fuck is Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah.
That's the only movie that, like, kind of has an anarchistic sense about it, that I can kind of get behind. I mean, the rest of the movies are really, really good. Philomena is the only one I never saw.
I didn't. Yeah, I guess that was another one I was supposed to talk about, but I was like, no. The one I was surprised by actually was original screenplay. I thought that they would not give it to Spike Jonze.
I was surprised. That was a good surprise. I mean, I lost that one. Yeah. I gave it to American Hustle because I thought all of these nominations, it's not winning anything. They're gonna give it for that. That'll be its Gibby. But agreed. I'm glad it went to her because that's a really interesting movie, really different. I was surprised it didn't win Best Production Design, because I think that's the biggest takeaway from that movie.
I see what you're saying, yeah. I think some people kind of did have that feeling while... I originally put her as my, like, heart decision. Like, that's the one that I thought should get the best original.
Yeah.
But I went the political route, and I was wrong on that one. So, I really thought that they did usually skip over Spike Jones because it's not Charlie Kaufman, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, so, yeah.
I'm glad that I was surprised, though, even though it made me lose money.
I didn't put any money down for mine. I was surprised about Best Production Design and going to Great Gatsby. Gatsby also won,
Hair and makeup or something?
Yeah, costume. Yeah. There you go. And I thought that would go to 12 Years a Slave. Not because it was necessarily... really grandiose costume.
I think I put American Hustle on that one too because I thought that the 70s and that movie was all about fucking hair.
Yeah, that's true.
And
but I just didn't know there was that much, even though those were kind of smaller awards, technical awards, I didn't know that the Academy was still even regarding Great Gatsby even that much.
I didn't either, and actually, the girl that won, she got 20, and I guess she normally wins these. They do this ballot every year, and she wins consistently. Mm-hmm. And she was like, it was 20s, it was big, it was flashy, it was blah blah. And she, we debated about it before when we were putting stuff down. I should have listened to her, but but there you go. No, I don't know. I always have a hard time because I have a hard time. Like, I always am really good about not going with my gut when it comes to the big ones, but it's the smaller, like, technical awards and stuff like that that I have a harder time playing the political stuff.
Yeah.
And those are the ones that will lose the ballot picking for you. Like,
Did you split your vote on director and best picture?
Yeah.
Oh, so you foresaw that?
Oh, yeah. I knew that. I had a really good feeling. I know that I read some factoid about how I think it's like zero Latino or Hispanic.
Huh?
I read a factoid about...
He was like the first Latino to win Best Director. Yeah.
Yeah, the Best Director, actor, any of those kind of things, you know what I'm saying? So
yeah.
I played the race card there and it won. And I was like, yeah, I knew it would win.
But I don't think he won, but...
No, I think he deserves it. I think he's very deserving, but I kind of think that was kind of like, I was like, eh, they're going to give it to him for that's part. I don't think that's why he won, but I think it's part of it. Part of the political process of why he won.
Yeah, I think more so it was because the Academy knew that, I think if they were voting with like their heart, they're like what they truly thought was the better movie. I think they liked Gravity more. Mm-hmm. And it also says a lot about the industry, and it kind of, you know, that they can still make big movies on a big scale and make a lot of money. And so they like whenever there's evidence of that.
Sure.
But I think ultimately they gave it to 12 Years a Slave because they would have felt like they were bad people if they didn't. Which isn't to say that's not a good movie, too. It is a good movie. But I feel like they were really torn between those two movies, and I knew that was the only way that they felt like they could kind of give them both awards.
And yeah, and I was right on both of those. I knew that that's how they were going to split it up, and I felt that was correct, and I was. So
yeah, I would have honestly given Gravity Best Picture as well, because I think
would you have gone more acting route then?
Yeah, honestly, as far as 12 Years a Slave goes, I think Michael Fassbender deserved it more so than Jared Leto, which is a role that I find actually somewhat problematic. And I really like Matthew McConaughey in Dallas Buyers Club, but because that movie kind of rubs me the wrong way in some issues, even as good as he is in that movie, I have a hard time really awarding it. And I would have probably given Best Actor to Bruce Dern personally.
That's your hard answer?
That's my hard answer, yeah. Is Bruce Dern. But yeah.
I would have still given to Leo. I thought that movie was great and people are like, "Oh, he's just doing a Leo." I don't agree at all. I think that he gave a very energetic and he gave a very It was like sinister, but playful. But he was so like nonchalant and could give a shit less that you didn't even almost notice how evil he was.
Yeah, no, it's a good performance. I mean, and he's putting all of himself into it. Yeah, I don't know exactly why. Maybe it's a sentimentality thing. The reason why I would give it to Bruce Stern, but. And you know, you're probably not.
I know. I thought Nebraska. I think when we did our 10, Nebraska was in my list for one of the best movies of the year.
Yeah, same with me. And I think it's a great performance, and you know, subtly
for
nuanced.
Specifically,
and,
yes.
Yeah. What about actual just like moments? Like, there were a few cringeworthy moments. When Act of Killing lost in documentary, which also was a huge surprise, and the presenter just or the. The person who recipient of the award just started randomly singing for a while.
Oh yeah,
like
that did happen.
"Go Home, You're Drunk." That was pretty ridiculous, and it got a standing ovation, which is even more ridiculous. After the memoriam, in memoriam, which was good, and it was sad to see all those faces. There was a lot of big people who died last year. Then Bette Midler has to sing "Wind Beneath My Wings."
That was
a bit much.
Horribly cheesy.
Yeah. I mean, that wasn't a good song when she did it for Beaches.
Agreed.
Let alone now.
No, it's pretty
unironically bad, singing Wind Beneath My Wings should... No, just stop that.
Well, it becomes ironic very quickly.
Yeah.
No, I can agree with those ones. You're really good about picking those ones. I always forget them because I ignore it happened. I'm just like, oh, that was stupid.
Yeah.
And then I go on. But I can't remember any right now. I guess the ones that I always remember, I'm like, oh, look at that person's horrible plastic surgery and Botox.
Oh, Kim Novak?
That was one of them.
Yeah.
John Travolta was pretty scary looking.
And his ridiculously not real hair. And then he completely destroyed that Frozen girl's name.
Oh, yeah. Well, some of them we had a hard time.
That's become a meme now.
We had a pretty chatty... Yeah, I've noticed that. We had a pretty chatty group, so I missed some of the stuff.
Yeah, but, same here. I didn't win the Oscar pool, even though we didn't bet money. But I kicked ass on Oscar bingo. I almost got a
blackout on that. But no, I'm serious. It was funny because the prizes for that one were some of our friends brought some of the DVDs. They either had it on Blu-ray now, or they didn't want because it was too sad.
Yeah,
that was their categories. And like I won like at the end, I won like three times, but I just didn't say anything because I was like, I don't want that. Do not need a DVD copy of Daredevil
for free. Why not?
Because I have it on Blu-ray.
Oh, okay. Never mind.
mostly all the... Well, there's also Twilight, but I gave that to a girl.
Oh, all right.
I played like I was going to take it for myself, but... and everybody got mad at me and booed, and I laughed. But it was okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was the Oscars. There was not a lot of big surprises. I would say it's a pretty safe year in general. But, you know, there were so many great movies that were nominated that, you know, there was a lot to root for. And even if the stuff you didn't win, want to win, you know, the stuff that did win was like, you know, pretty good also.
Mm-hmm.
So let's go ahead and move on to our reviews.
So you weren't surprised that Gravity won like a bazillion awards for technical stuff?
No, not at all.
Yeah, no, I don't think anybody was.
I knew that would happen. I was a little surprised it went to director, but that's about it.
Not that surprised, because
that is how I voted, but...
Yeah, good. Good news.
All right, cool. So we're going to be talking about Hayao Miyazaki's The Wind Rises. I think. Isn't that what we saw?
That is what we saw.
I thought that's what we agreed on, but I hadn't talked about it with you for a little while, so... why don't you go ahead and set that up?
Okay, I believe this is supposed to be Miyazaki's last film.
Mm-hmm.
It's about a boy, as a child, this kid has a dream of building some of the best aircrafts in the world. And it's kind of about him growing up and his projects being, you know, either used inappropriately and should he still, kind of this ethical debate if he should still do it. And it's kind of about that and him finding love, which it ends up more being about. And kind of how that pushes him to be able to reach this dream.
And this is all pre-World War II Japan.
Yeah, this is, so there's definitely some cultural references.
Yeah.
The whole thing's set in Japan, so that's a big cultural reference.
Yeah, for a little while we're in Germany, but it comes back to Japan.
We also have dreamscapes and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Maybe in Italy, I don't know, wherever Dreamland is. this film, Miyazaki films in general I like, and he's one of the more accessible of the Japanese anime guys, and one of the more highly revered, and I completely agree with why he is. This film, to me, I think I'm getting the right kind of painting. It has a very, like, impressionistic... The backgrounds are all very soft and kind of wavy, and the lines aren't hard and filled in. And so it kind of sets you up in this kind of... it kind of sets you into this weird... they have these dream sequences that kind of bleed in with the movie a lot, and so it kind of gives it kind of an ethereal quality. And it's a quiet, beautiful movie. It's maybe for me, it's maybe a little slow in parts. I think that it could be trimmed a bit. But overall, it was good. Even the love story, even though it got maybe a little like at times, it was still pretty good. What was kind of funny too is there was like the 7-year-old boy that was like 7-8-year-old kid that was in the audience, and every time anything like love oriented got up, he was like, "Gross!" And like he would say it in full. The first time it was funny, the next few times it was like, "Please shut up."
Less funny. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's interesting. Yeah, I thought this was pretty good. It's definitely well made, it's well written, it's well considered. The voice acting by the American cast, who, you know, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and
I thought it was well written. Sometimes I think that the voices weren't completely filled out. Like, you could see, like, mouths moving and no dialogue coming out, and that was...
Well, when you're dubbing over an original Japanese cast, that's kind of what happens.
Well, no, there were, like, background characters that would move their mouth, and...
nothing was coming out.
Nothing would come out, period. It wasn't just, like... like missed dialogue or something like that.
Yeah. But it's a very, it's kind of a grown up movie. This isn't, you know, like even some of the other, Miyazaki Spirited movies, away. like, well, I mean, I recently watched Princess Mononoke, which is kind of a fantasy action movie. But even something like Ponyo or,
sure.
What was the one that came out last year? That was The Borrowers.
What?
It was basically The Borrowers, but, Secret World of Arrietty. Okay. So these movies are, you know, have a little bit more kind of bouncy, fun type of stuff for kids, where this movie definitely feels like it's made by a 70-plus-year-old with kind of that same sort of autumnal energy.
Mm-hmm.
It's very kind of reflecting on society, on growing up, on dreams, expectations, you know, their political history, all of this stuff. And it does so in a really, really good way. Actually, the movie it reminded me of the most while I was watching it was probably Steven Spielberg's Empire of the Sun, which is interesting because that's about when Japan invades China after these crafts were made. And so that was a really interesting thing. I mean, this movie got a lot of controversy during its Oscar campaign and awards campaign, because there is a huge sect of people who said, why are we heroizing these people who made war machines?
But that was like the ethical question. I knew that there was a debate. I didn't know that that's what the one is. This is one of the ones I got wrong. I should have, of course, you're supposed to go with the big Disney win, always, but I was like, no, this is his last film. He should get it. And I thought that they would be, you know, grown-ups and do that, but they didn't.
No.
They chose Frozen.
So. They chose Frozen. Well, Frozen made bucket loads of money and is still making bucket loads of money. So I knew they weren't going to vote against their cash cow. But no, this is a good movie. I do agree. It is so reflecting and so impressionistic that it's a little languid. It's a little slow.
Mm-hmm.
And it's over 2 hours. I think it was 210, something like that. It could definitely Correct. Serve to be 20 minutes shorter. There's some scenes that could be tightened up. But there's nothing here that's particularly bad to go into. I'd say, you know, if this is a person's first Miyazaki movie, that's probably not the best place to start.
No. There wasn't enough arms being shot off with arrows for me, personally. That's the kind of film that I want.
Or raccoons with giant magical ball sacks.
Yes, exactly.
But I think it's... anyone who watches this, even if you don't 100% enjoy it, it's hard to look at it and say, this isn't a very talented person who made it. That this is a really good story that's worth telling.
Yeah, and he has a way about his films that kind of draws you in like an old film kind of does.
Yeah, it feels very classic, like, when you watch it, not just because this type of animation, you know, hand-drawn, is so rare to see in the theater anymore, but it's something about the way the storytelling is. It just feels much more kind of like this could have been made in the 50s.
Well, and you kind of already talked about it, but part of it was also the writing.
Yeah.
I thought that the writing was very good. They brought up all these wind and wing references, and they tied them all together.
Yeah.
And kind of made this integrated thing. And that's the kind of writing in general I like
from well, things, and even
it's kind of poetic and...
And
kind of sets a theme and a mood and stuff like that. And so
the juxtaposition between the love story and this overarching story of him, you know, accomplishing these goals, being a flight engineer, the way the movie ends, the note that it decides to end on really ties those up beautifully. And it really kind of leaves on a kind of nihilistic down note, considering, you know, the bright-eyed innocence up to that point. Even though we know he's making these crafts that are eventually going to be used to bomb entire cities and used for, like, suicide flights and that kind of stuff. The character himself, you root for him.
Mm-hmm.
And you really are kind of...
But it kind of... Well, yeah,
there's sort of a tragedy to it all.
There's a tragedy to it all, but it's also kind of a double-edged sword kind of motive, too, because it kind of brought to this, like, kind of, you know, we talk about Japanese and technology and their engineering sense, you know. This film almost kind of introduces this is where it began, almost,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so it's kind of a double-edged sword. It did lead to this, you know, lots of ugly things within the culture, but it led to a lot of the beauty and a lot of the country's success in the future as well. So it's kind of a weird... So I thought it was very lyrical and beautiful, and I thought the message was really cool. And the controversy and the reason it lost...
I don't think that's the reason it lost. The reason it lost was just because Frozen was so big. Like, you couldn't ignore the success of that movie when... It, like, won 4 weekends in a row and then was, like, number 3 for 6 weekends, then started winning weekends again. Like,
well, that... I ignored the fact that it did so well, so...
Yeah. I'm not saying that Frozen is a better movie. I think this movie is, as a storytelling level, much better. But I think...
Miyazaki's last film, and they don't give him the award, I just think that that's kind of...
Ridiculous, yeah.
I think that that's a poor judgment call from somebody who's been... such an innovator and such a great filmmaker for so long.
Yeah.
Personally.
And one of the only people really working in animation that is kind of an auteur.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, well, cool. Well, let's go ahead and now and move on to our Netflix homework, which I assigned you last week.
Mm-hmm.
It's available to watch on the Netflix instant streaming. And that is Doug Trumbull's Silent Running. And this stars Bruce Dern, who we talked about was in Nebraska, and this came out in 1972. So Doug Trumbull was the director who most famously was a special effects guy. He worked for Stanley Kubrick for 2001 Space Odyssey, but he also worked somewhat recently with Terrence Malick for Tree of Life, because Malick wanted that kind of 2001 vibe to some of that movie. And this doesn't quite have the same scope and size and ambition of those movies, but it's a little science fiction movie about a man who's working kind of in a outer space biodome, where he's trying to preserve the Earth's natural resources in space after the Earth to come to some sort of utopia where there's no crime and there's no unemployment had to destroy almost all of natural nature, trees, etc.
Yeah, some of the concepts are a little ridiculous.
Yeah, well, it's fairly on the nose. I mean, you could tell that this movie was written right at the point of the Go Green campaigns and the, you know, cleaning up the Earth and the environmental politics that were just kind of starting in the early 70s. And it's definitely at the forefront of the writer's concerns in this movie.
See, I thought we might disagree on that then. I thought that was the beginnings of the film was like that. But it was kind of, this film was weird to me. Bruce Dern in this film, his character Fremont Lowell is like, he starts out the movie, I don't know if I've just seen too many comic book movies at this point and read too many comic books, but he started out like the movie like a comic book villain would.
Kind of, yeah.
He killed all these people. He did some pretty horrible things, and he even like feels remorse and guilt for it. And it's not like they're like, and it doesn't really feel like the movie puts a Band-Aid on the fact that he did these horrible things.
Mm-hmm. It ends up having a play later in the story. It's not like he gets away with it exactly.
Well, the other thing is it wasn't like nature triumphed in this, because at the end he did succumb to needing people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought that was an interesting place to end when you started with such a high like green kind of movie.
Yeah.
So I thought the actual story was kind of intriguing in a strange sort of way. It had a really the movie in general was sort of strange, because you are correct, it didn't have the scope of something like Tree of Life or 2001 Space Odyssey.
Yeah.
But it was somewhere in between that and like a Star Wars film.
Yeah,
kind of. Like they didn't know, like the film like kind of was like confused, and it warped all these kind of weird characteristics into one character who ran around with an R2-D2 kind of units.
Yeah.
And planted flowers and played cards and did stuff.
And that's my favorite stuff in the movie. Him and those robots and their interactions. And, you know, he's basically acting against himself. But they managed to put a lot of personality in these kind of cheesy-looking drones.
I kind of liked them, though.
Yeah, I did, too. They sort of become characters, and can get behind him. And there's sort of what I really like about this movie is there's this kind of sense of loneliness to it.
Mm-hmm.
And this one man on a mission and him kind of feeling like nobody gets me. Sure. And then and the way that ends up kind of playing into his character overall. And I think, you know, Bruce Dern really brings a lot to this movie, because, you know, when you're working against these cardboard box looking robots, it's hard to, in saying some of this dialogue, it's hard to really play that straight, but he plays it totally for keeps. He's 100% dedicated to this role.
Yeah.
And brings a lot of emotion to it.
I also think, though, it does fall into some of that 70s camp kind of quality.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause sometimes
it's a little pulpy.
And his character sometimes is a little over the top, but it leads to a very strange film in general.
Yeah.
Like the film, like I said, you kind of feel comfortable in the film because it is almost like a weird Star Wars Forbidden Planet kind of whatever kind of ride.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you've got this really weird stuff going on, like killing his cohorts, feeling guilty for it, needing humanity but not wanting it, and just like... being human. Like there's this moment where he's Like, he used to, like, just criticize how people are eating, like, this fake synthetic food.
Yeah.
But then there's, like, this point in the film where, like, he goes and he's eating the synthetic food.
Yeah.
And, like, the robots are, like, looking at him, apparently, and he starts to feel guilty and goes back to eating it. And he discovers the forest again.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's sort of a strange hodgepodge by the end, because I don't feel like some of it's clearly... It's not a clearly lined movie where, like, you know everything that you... It doesn't have, like, your definite, like, this is an answer kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I kind of like that quality that it is messy.
Yeah, I agree. I think that he's, you know, the writers are kind of struggling with their ideas, but is full of ideas. Like, that's one of the things that's cool about this era of science fiction, you know, kind of pre-Star Wars, is that they're constantly tackling social issues.
Yeah.
And even if they don't, you know, it kind of reflective of 1972 and that kind of time, there, you know, there's all this political tension, social tension, but there's, we don't know what the answers are. We don't know what the next step should be. There's that kind of uncertainty that makes it an interesting movie.
Mm-hmm.
Even if, you know, some stuff in it doesn't work.
Right.
I'd say it's definitely worth seeing.
No, for sure. Especially since it's a Netflix thing and you're paying the low price of $7.99 or whatever.
Yeah, a month.
It is a month. No, this is one of those films that you should check out and kind of, I think just for some of the designs and stuff like that. Like, it does seem kind of reminiscent. Like, I feel like I've seen kind of reminiscent things in films. Like, I thought of Moon and a few other films.
So. Yeah, well, certainly Moon, I think, was greatly influenced by it.
Kind of borrowed, yeah.
I mean, that movie is in general, a sort of a pastiche of this era of sci-fi. I mean, it calls back to Silent Running, it calls back to 2001, it calls back to Solaris.
Yeah, definitely, but I also thought that, like, the robot played by Kevin Spacey in Moon.
Yeah.
I thought he was actually fairly reminiscent of these robots.
Yeah,
just a very simple design and kind of silly almost.
Yeah, they gave him a howl voice, but in personality, he's kind of more like these.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. So, it is interesting, and I think people should check it out.
Yeah.
If you're into science fiction. If you're not, however, that might be a different question. I think that aren't into sci-fi, I don't think would like this film very much.
Well, I mean, it kind of depends on what you mean by that, because I think there are some people, when they hear the word sci-fi, they think aliens with laser guns.
Sure.
And that isn't this. But if you're expecting aliens with laser guns, or you like your sci-fi to have an action inflection, it's not here.
Agreed. Yeah, it's not that kind of movie, but it's also, I guess I wouldn't say that it's for... I guess it caters to a very specific kind of science fiction.
Yeah.
Nerd.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think even the alien people could maybe get something kind of weird out of it, because it does kind of lead into some of, like...
It has a little bit of a pulp quality to it, yeah.
It does have a lot of a pulp quality, and besides that, it kind of... Like, it's not like one of the, like, Demolition Man or kind of movies, but
yeah.
For some reason feels like it at the very start to me. Just maybe it's the one soul lone character versus the world or something like that, I don't know.
Yeah.
But, no, but a kind of a cool movie. Bruce Dern. Yeah.
Well, what do you have for me next week?
Next week I have a film for you that came out recently called Bad Milo.
All right.
It's a newer film, and it's a horror comedy, and other than that, I'd like to surprise you. I think you kind of know about it. It's about a demon in the belly, but...
Ken Marino is in it. Have you seen it already?
I have not.
Oh, okay. So we'll both be catching this weekend.
When I saw it was on, I thought I'd save it, and
yeah.
We'd watch it after our sci-fi month. So.
All right. Well, if anybody has any comments about any of the things we talked about this week, Oscar surprises, misses, wins, what have you, The Wind Rises, anything by Miyazaki, or Doug Trumbull's Silent Running, or Bad Milo, you can get in contact to us through jabberonthedrone@gmail.com. Drop us a line there, have any questions. You can also contact us at Facebook at facebook.com/jabberpodcast. Like us there, and you can see when we post news items between episodes, as well as any updates about the show itself. You can subscribe to our Podbean archives at jabberinthedrone.podbean.com, where you can also find our RSS feed, and use that to follow us either on Stitcher Radio or Pocket Cast, as well as iTunes, where we are available to stream from your mobile device. You can read my movie reviews at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com, where I post my movie reviews that I write every week for the Idaho State Journal, as well as the articles I write for the MacGuffin. You can find at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. I just recently posted a review for all of the live-action shorts that were nominated for the Academy Awards. That one surprised me. And Richard, you can find at his new blog at, can you rattle that off? I don't have it written here yet.
It's RD Wally, and that's spelled W-O-L-L-E-Y. The RD and the W are all capitalized, .weebly.com.
All right. And do you have anything new on there yet?
No. I'm probably going to do a review like a month, every month or so. I will post. I think we should start posting stuff that we're doing, maybe on when we do certain reviews and stuff. Maybe we should post it in Jabber and the Drone so people can check that out. But on Facebook. So
sure.
So when something new comes up, but hopefully there'll be some content coming soon, some more content. So
all right. Until then, we'll talk to you next week.
Okay. Goodbye.
Bye.